Welcome, everybody, to Elmtown episode 14. We're starting a new series today where we interview individuals from the community to find out about their story, their life, how they got into what they're doing now, how they got into programming, how they got into Elm, etc. And we're calling it Spotlight. You know, have you ever been to school and they say, like, we're going to do Spotlight on someone and find out more about them? Well, that's what we're doing here, too. But before we get too much farther into it, I want to talk about our sponsors, our lovely, beautiful sponsors whom we love. Number one, we have Humble Spark, which is a development consultancy based in Chicago, specializes in web and front end. They provide practical experience and expertise in front end development. They use modern tools and frameworks, including Elm. They also support the Elm community through investing time in open source contribution, screencasts, and other learning materials. And they are also the authors of Ellie app. And if you haven't used Ellie, you should, because it's great. It's, you can use Elm directly in the browser without bootstrapping anything. You just go on there, you write Elm, you compile it, it works. You can even add packages from the package repo. So thanks to Humble Spark for being such a contributor to the community and such a supporter of the podcast. Next is Day One. It's the company that I work for. It's a beautiful journaling and life archiving app for Mac and iOS. And I can say beautiful because I have also been a user, not just the producer. So if I may say so myself, it's a beautiful app, and it's coming soon to other platforms. We're making great progress on the web, and we use Elm heavily on the web client. And Daily Drip, which is a training service that makes keeping up to date on programming skills easy. They provide a small but powerful set of lessons to level, well, sorry, the set of lessons is not small. The lessons themselves are small. The set is quite large, in fact. And they're small lessons, so you don't have to block out hours of time just to learn one concept. They should have little snippets that will let you get leveled up just a little bit at a time. And that includes not only Elm, but Elixir and CSS and HTML. After you sign up, you'll get a short video or reading delivered to your inbox, and it should only take you about 5 minutes to consume. So that's a great way to learn a little bit every day. And if you sign up using the coupon code ELMTOWN, I should be positive and not say if, I should say when you sign up using the coupon code ELMTOWN, you'll save $9 on your first month, and that will give you a whole month of the Elm topic to try out for free. And last but not least is Futurist, which is, or Futurice, and I don't actually know how to pronounce that because Futurice is from all over the world. It's a new breed of innovation consultancy with digital values at its core. They believe in happy people, happy customers, and happy users. They're Elm users, also community contributors and innovators in the open source space. They hire good people and they do good work. So if you are interested in working at a fantastic place, go ahead and contact them. Or if you're interested in hiring fantastic people, contact them as well. So big thanks, as always, to Fergus for editing these episodes just out of his own good heart. And he does a great job cleaning up my mistakes and making things better. And now, you heard a chuckle during the intro. That chuckle belongs to our dear friend Kevin Yank.
Hello.
And guess what? Today we're going to do Spotlight on Kevin.
Yay.
Hey, guess what, Kevin? You sound so good. I love your microphone setup.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Way to go. You did
podcasting. I could do a whole podcast about how much I love this microphone.
Oh, well, maybe we'll save that for another episode, another time. What kind of microphone is it, just so we know?
It's a Rode Podcaster.
What? So it's specifically for podcasting?
Well, that's how they market it, sure.
Oh, that sounds great. Mine's a Samsung G-Track.
All right.
And I think I bought like the only one in existence because nothing goes with it or on it. It's kind of sad. But
I'm now picturing people listening to this show just as a comparative review of these two microphones.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, maybe that's going to happen. Hey, if you're thinking of starting an Elm podcast,
Yeah. Feel
free to do it, everyone and anyone, because even though I'm so famous because I'm the only Elmtown podcast permanent host, you know, I'd love to have friends in the space too.
Are you saying there's more demand than you can keep up with?
I'm just saying the more the merrier. More friends equals more happiness. And I was joking about being so famous. I'm not so famous. Just a guy with a microphone, you know.
Let's make you famous today, Murphy.
All right. Thanks, Kevin. I'll sit in your shadow. Maybe I'll get some of your table scraps and that'll make me famous. All right. So, Kevin, let's start at the beginning. What I kind of want to do here is just to build a picture of your life in the way that it relates to development, because all of us have different backstories. All of us face different challenges, but maybe some of us will be able to learn from the things that you've faced in your years of experience. And maybe some of us will feel a little bit better about ourselves if we hear that we're facing similar challenges to what you did. So why don't you tell us like how you started out when you were young, what got you interested in programming? That's the very beginning there.
Oh, golly. All right. Well, I think as for many people my age,
Do you mind sharing your age?
I'm 38.
Okay, great.
And yeah, as like a lot of people my age, I imagine I got into computers when my parents bought a computer and said, hey, have a play with it. And I wish I knew what made them think that I would be into using the computer as a programming tool, not just as a thing to play games on, which is what most of my friends were using computers for at the time.
And me.
Yeah. But it was an old Apple, an Apple IIe clone.
Nice.
So this was back during the days when Apple let other people make Apple computers. And it was one of these beige boxes with the keyboard built into the computer, and the screen was all green. But you could plug it into your TV and see color display.
Whoa. And that was all CLI at that point, right?
But you could write programs that caused graphics to appear on the screen. And, you know, they had games like California Games and Summer Games and Moon Patrol and stuff on it. But awesome. I guess I started programming in Logo and moved quickly on to BASIC. And I was learning these through magazines for the Apple hobbyist community that my parents would buy and plop down on the table for me to check out when I had an interest.
Was this like the Homebrew Computer Club publication? Did they have one? I don't remember.
I vaguely remember the titles of these magazines being things like A Plus and some stuff like that. And it was like Apple Power User magazines. And they'd always have a section near the back that was like, type all this BASIC code into your Apple and it'll do stuff. Those were the days where you hand transcribed two pages of assembly code.
And awesome.
There would be a screenshot in the article of what you could expect to happen if you typed it all perfectly. And there was one game called Balloons that would cause balloons to float up the screen, and you could pop them somehow, but I never got it to run. And I don't know to this day whether it was a typo in my code or in the stuff that was printed in the magazine.
So I'm interested in knowing what happened when you like wrote the assembly code incorrectly. How did the computer respond to that?
It probably said something like Stack Overflow.
Okay, so it had some runtime errors. It wouldn't just like overwrite RAM and computer crash.
No,
it would.
I definitely remember you were writing commands like put and pop that actually, dealt with actual memory space on the computer. So I'm sure if I put my mind to it, I could have crashed the operating system with
that
stuff.
That's awesome. Okay, so that's kind of how you got into the programming initially. Why Logo? Was that part of the publications that were coming through?
I assume it was like, at the time, it was the beginner programming language. It was like, if you wanted to learn the concepts of programming in an accessible way by moving what they call a turtle around the screen. So when you fire up Logo, you get a little arrow in the center of your screen pointing upward. And the commands you can issue are like, turn right, turn left, move forward, put the pen down so that when you move, you draw a line behind you, and pick the pen up so that you're no longer drawing a line.
It's turtle graphics.
Yeah. And, to this day, like I think of that to this day because at least in Melbourne, one of the biggest employers in Melbourne for web developers, REA, famously their coding test is toy robot. And it's you're asked to implement basically what you had in Logo, which was move this thing around a grid, and it can take instructions from a text file. And if the instructions in the text file should be validated and should not allow the robot to walk off the edge of the table, for example. And it's just this weird parallel of you're basically implementing Logo as your coding challenge if you're trying for a job at REA.
So you were interested in programming as programming, not as just a method to get that game to come up on your screen.
At the time, my biggest ambition was to write a game that my friends would play. And what would happen is I'd spend like three nights coding something silly, and then I'd invite all my friends over to try it out. And then they'd say, can it do this? And I'd be like, I have no idea how to make it do that, but come back in a week and I'll see. I was... I would have been like 14, 15 at the time. And so the games I was coming up with was what you'd expect would be born of a 14-year-old's mind, like a database of insults for your friends. And you could type in new ones, or you could guess what it would bring up an insult, and you had to guess who it was referring to in our friend group.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, we should have had a Kickstarter back then. We could have funded the crap out of that idea.
That reminds me also of my school experiences when we were first doing programming in junior high. Our games were like, I think we made one called Psychologist that just, I think it just like insulted you no matter what you said.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those were the days.
Yeah.
Great, very good use of programming.
So that would have been in BASIC. I implemented that. And for those who've not dabbled in BASIC, that is a relentlessly procedural programming language. This is the days of go-to statements where every line of your code would have a number, and at any point anywhere in your program you could write a statement that said go to 10, and the program would jump to whatever was going on line 10 in your program. And I remember there were subroutines, and I feel like we don't talk about subroutines in programming anymore, except in bad sci-fi scripts. Like every once in a while, there's a Star Trek episode that says, oh, they replaced a subroutine in the main computer. And I haven't heard the word subroutine actually used in programming since my days of programming BASIC. But subroutines were basically functions that you could call by name instead of by number.
I'll let you know that I have, and that was at college just a number of years ago. Because it was in the very difficult class where we learned assembly.
Yes.
See, in assembly. So, yeah, that's also where we learned subroutines. I mean, not that I don't think we had subroutines in assembly, of course, but in C we did. And so they were like, here, it's a subroutine. No, we had functions as well. Anyway, I'm sorry. I digress. This is about you. This isn't like Exploding Socks and Kevin Yang spotlight. Okay, so keep going.
I like the idea that we'll learn about you little by little over the course of many podcasts.
There you go. They're all partially my spotlight. Yeah, just inject myself in there. Okay, so subroutines, fantastic. You had them in BASIC.
Sure.
And they were extremely difficult to debug.
Yeah.
I have been told, and I experienced as well. So you moved on from there and did what?
Well, I think the next thing I remember was the web coming into, or at least the internet coming into my awareness. And all this stuff was pre-internet until I vividly remember lots of talk about things like the information superhighway. And there was this thing called the internet coming that would change everything because it could carry vast amounts of information at light speed around the globe. And none of that kind of gelled in my mind as to what exactly this thing was. I'm sure like at that time in my life, a year went by where I knew there was this thing called the internet that I didn't know what in practice it actually was. And I think that was probably a common experience at the time. And I had a friend in high school named Ben Charon. Ben, if you're listening, how's it going? And he knew something about the internet. And I remember vividly a day in class, he was sitting at the next desk, and I said, Ben, what's the internet? And he turned to me and he said, you wouldn't understand.
How kind.
And I think I owe a lot of my future career to that moment, that I took it as a personal challenge of, sure, I could understand. And made it my business to figure out what this thing, the internet, was.
So what age were you when you got dial-up?
Wow. I think I would have had my first dial-up internet after I moved to Australia, so 97, so maybe 20 years ago now. So 17?
Okay.
Yeah. And the internet, when I first experienced it, was something I got at university. I think a lot of people at my age, again, had their first experience of the internet not as something that you could have at home, but something you got through an educational institution or an employer.
That makes sense.
And yeah, so I went to university at the University of Newcastle in Newcastle, New South Wales, here in Australia for the first time. And the biggest perk of being a university student at that time is in your off hours, you could go to a computer lab and use the internet. Up until that point, we had had dial-up at home, but it was for dialing into BBS systems. There was no sort of central internet service provider. You dialed into a modem that was sitting at someone's house, and when you logged in, you were at a command prompt that was provided by a specific system that they had that would have games on it or message boards or other sorts of little applications. And we all at the time had a list of maybe 10 BBSs that we would log into once a day and check our messages and play our RPG games. And some of these BBSs were connected to each other, so there were these mail services that the BBSs would call each other once a day to exchange mail. And it was this primordial internet before it was always on. It was kind of an asynchronous internet between these bulletin board systems. But yeah, university was the first time we actually got access to this always-on internet system. And we all chatted on IRC. This was how the nerds communicated at university.
And it stayed that way until now, until Slack killed IRC for many years. So where are you from, Kevin, then? Canada, right?
Yeah, I'm from Montreal in Canada originally, yes.
But then you moved to Australia for school?
Yeah, well, I was in school when my family moved to Australia, yeah.
Oh, okay. And that was, so you attended high school in Canada then?
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Okay. Did you do any programming while you were there at high school?
Just more of the I think, yeah, the Apple stuff was happening while I was in high school. And okay. We got our first PC after we moved to Australia around the same time that I started university. And yeah, it was a Compaq Presario running some variety of Windows. And I remember being blown away that you could play music from a CD at the same time as use some other application.
Oh, yeah.
But shortly after that, I discovered, I got into the OS2 operating system. Did you ever use OS2, Murphy?
No, I never did.
So it was an alternate operating system, eventually sold by IBM. I'm not sure if, I think IBM started OS2. But there's kind of a homebrew meetup club in Newcastle where I was living at the time. They focused on OS2, and this was at the time, meetups, everyone packed their computers into their car and carried them to the community center or wherever we were having our meetup, and then everyone would plug in their computers and show each other stuff on their computers. Again, before the internet connected everything, we all had to carry our computers with us everywhere. The thing that was super exciting about OS2 is it was the first operating system I used that had a web browser built in.
Oh, interesting.
And it was called Web Explorer, if memory serves. And I vividly remember giving a Newcastle OS2 user group meetup talk explaining the web and how it was better than Gopher.
Okay.
Gopher it was similar to the web, but it was more like files and folders that you could traverse. So there weren't these there weren't these pages, but there were folders, and if you clicked on a file, that file would open on your computer. But I think there was some sort of primitive linking structure between these files and folders and Gopher servers. But the web was the first time that it was document-based. It had this experience of hypertext where the links were built right into the documents that you were reading. And I gave some early demo of the web on OS2. And I think at the time I may have described it as like choose your own adventure for your computer, that you could make your own choose your own adventures by writing documents and you could have links to other places. But yeah, that was my first exposure to the web through the OS2 operating system. And I just remember thinking, wow, an OS that has this built into it, that's it's this creative medium that anyone can build pages in, and your pages look just as professional as someone else's pages because the formatting is fairly limited and everyone's server names look the same. And so I just remember thinking, if this thing ever takes off, it'll be this democratizing medium that everyone has an equal voice in. And I remember being really inspired by that.
Well, looks like it came through.
Yeah.
I think we could probably say now that the web is mostly successful.
I think it's got a bright future.
Okay, good. So I never used OS 2, but I actually, my parents were devout Mac users. And
oh, yeah.
also had the clone machines, and after the clone machines went away, they kept buying Macs. And so I grew up on Mac. My first web browsers were Netscape Navigator and Netscape Commander when those existed.
I had completely forgotten about Netscape Commander.
Yeah, I don't know the difference still, but I do remember that there were those two. Do you know?
No, but there was I remember there was Netscape and there was Netscape Gold, and the Gold one was the one that had the mail client and the calendar and stuff built in.
Oh man, I don't remember that.
someone who knows a lot more about early web browsers is going to write in to correct us.
Yeah, please do. Just send us a thing on Twitter, or when we get the website fixed with the contact email address,
yeah,
go ahead and send an email. Or you can email me. That'd be cool to put on the show. In any case, so that's great. Inception of the internet. And meantime, you're at college. What are you studying?
I was studying computer engineering.
And that was, it seems like that, I guess that wouldn't be a new major, but that the internet was new.
No,
relatively.
Yeah, for sure. And so at the time, I had this big choice of, I knew I wanted to do a degree in computers. By that point, the programming bug had me hooked, and it was fairly clear that I would have a reasonable career if I focused on that. It's I think something that people in our position, Murphy, have as a privilege is that our hobby, our interest, lines up well with a career that will see you have a fairly cushy lifestyle. And
yeah.
I remember feeling lucky at the time while my friends wrestled with whether they should do a law degree or a business degree because they needed to figure out how to make some money in their life. And in my case, I was like, I'm a nerd about computers. Is that cool? And they someone would say, yeah, you'll make plenty of money doing that. And I'd be like, okay, well, let's just keep doing that then.
And I agree.
Yeah.
Hope that lasts.
Yeah. It's quite a privilege. But the big choice back then for me was, do I do a computer science degree or a computer engineering degree?
Okay. So what was the difference?
Well, as it was explained to me, was computer science, you'll learn to program. But computer engineering, you will learn the whole computer. And so if you're interested in programming, you'll probably learn that yourself anyway. You should do a degree that will expand your horizons and teach you how the hardware works, and that will make you a better programmer.
So you were doing electrical engineering as well.
Yeah,
circuits,
absolutely. Lots of math subjects, lots of physics and especially electrical, even some mechanical engineering and chemistry subjects, just
wow.
A lot of a broad science base on top of the programming, and eventually did do some subjects in things like microcircuit design and computer architecture that I have never used professionally directly, but it's certainly when things go wrong in a computer, I probably understand a bit more about what the errors that get spat out mean, because
that's super cool. And so you finished that in a normal time frame, I assume.
Yeah, it was a 4-year degree in Canada. I started that degree in Australia and finished it in Canada. And in Australia,
okay,
those kind of university degrees are 5 years because you go to university straight out of high school, whereas in Canada there's a 2-year college step between the high school and university normally. So the university degrees are a little shorter here in Canada. But yeah, finished it in a normal time.
So your family moved back to Canada during that period.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and then I got my first job writing websites and worked at a place called Alcan Aluminium. And I'm somewhat embarrassed to admit that my dad got me my job there. He was working high up in the executive branch at Alcan, and he heard that there was a summer intern position in their information department, which is what you called a library, an internal corporate library back then.
Nice.
But the information department needed a website an internal website that the employees of Alcan Aluminium could consult to see what new books were available in the library. So I think you might not find this funny, but I find it a hilarious irony that the first website I ever worked on was a list of books that people could check out if they wanted some useful information.
That is pretty funny.
And so they brought me in and they showed me the bookshelf and said, make a website that lists all of these things and write us some documentation so that when we get our new books in each month, we can add them to the site. And I barely knew how to do that at that point. I knew just enough HTML, and CSS was just starting to be a thing that I had a book about that I could read quickly enough to teach myself how to do it and make it work on this website. And they did not give me any server access. I remember that the books I was reading would say, okay, if you want a website that'll list things, then you can put those things in a database and then write a program that will list all of the things in the database in HTML. And I thought, that's cool. I've never done that before. How do I put things on the server? And they said, oh no, just give us a folder of HTML files and that's all we need. So I had to take the step back and write the static HTML website by hand.
That sounds like tons of work.
Yeah, tons of copying and pasting, lots of comments in the HTML. Commenting in HTML, a lost art, let me tell you. And the comments were there to tell people how to update it. And I wrote these big Word documents that said, when there is a new book, you need to go to this file and find this comment and copy and paste the section of code between these two comments and then change all of these pieces of information for the new book. When there's a new category, you need to add a category page and then go to the categories list page and copy and paste this code. So it was like, yeah, handwritten instructions for hand editing HTML for keeping a website up to date. I don't know if anyone ever followed those instructions after I finished my internship, but I was meticulous.
That was probably a great exercise in technical writing.
Yeah.
So was this, what year would this have been?
That would have been 1998.
Would PHP and MySQL have been around at that point? Kicking in people's hands.
I had a book about ASP back then. So like ASP 2 and 3 were the thing. I remember being really disappointed that I couldn't do this thing where, you might remember this. What was the database that shipped with Microsoft Office back then?
Oh, I don't know, because I was all Mac.
Someone's going to know. It's killing me.
Access?
Yeah, Microsoft Access, that's right.
Okay, I guess I
didn't
know.
You could write a Microsoft Access database and then write ASP that pulled all the records out of the Access database to make a website. And I read about this and was amazed, didn't have the infrastructure to do it at Alcan. And so I was very disappointed by that. But before I got a chance to apply my trade in ASP, PHP did take over my world in a future job, yeah.
So tell me about that. You dropped after the internship, you skedaddled.
Well, I did the internship while I was studying, so it was a summer job. And then when I finished university, that's when I got a job offer down here in Australia for some people who had been working at Sausage Software, which was a company that burned bright and quick in the Melbourne startup scene during the internet bubble. They made the hot dog HTML editor, which some people might remember as an early competitor to things like Allaire Home Site and eventually Dreamweaver.
I used Taco HTML editor.
Oh, wow.
That was a...
Yeah, the software
sounds
had the best
similar
names back then.
Yeah.
Hot Dog HTML Editor, yeah, their logo was like a silver sausage.
Oh, that's
and
pretty funny.
I was really active on their web forum communities, answering people's questions about HTML and sharing shortcuts in this editor for how to write websites if quickly and efficiently, and got enough attention from those writings. They asked me to write articles for their community site. I remember setting up a Java applet on the site, that so they gave me write access to their support site at one point, so that I could set up a Java chat applet for people to chat awesome. In real time about the Hot Dog HTML editor.
That's great. Was it shareware?
The Java applet or Hot Dog? Hot Dog was shareware. Dog. Yeah, for sure.
That's something we don't have anymore either. Shareware?
No, definitely not.
It's all freemium now.
Yeah. So yeah, you could use it for 30 minutes or so, and then it would bring up a nag box, and then it would bring up a nag box every 5 minutes until you paid for it.
Moment of silence for shareware.
Oh,
there we go.
Yep,
it's a bygone age. Okay, so you used it. You ended up paying for it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And by the time I finished university, Sausage Software was in the flames of the internet bubble bursting, and some people had left. And they said, we're starting this new company called SitePoint. Kevin, would you like to come and write for us?
Oh, it was the same people?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
So the CEO of SitePoint, Mark Harbottle, was the online marketing manager of Sausage Software when I first met him. But by the time he was in a position to give me a job, he had started this new thing called SitePoint, which was a webmaster resource site. And so I had gone from making websites to spending a lot of time writing to share with other people how to make websites. And my first real job out of university was in that sort of technical writing space, working for SitePoint.com. They hired me to write a PHP tutorial, and I didn't know PHP when they offered me that job. So I bought a book from Rocks Press. I don't know. They're still kicking around in some form, Rocks Press, but these were the bright red books with a black and white portrait of a nerd on the front, the author in question. And so I picked up Professional PHP from Rocks Press, and I read it. And whenever I finished a chapter, I would then write an article for SitePoint.com sharing what I'd learned. And this became a series of articles that got a huge boost of traffic to SitePoint.com. And the next thing that was suggested by my boss at the time was, we should bundle up these 10 articles you wrote and sell them as a book. And I thought, you're crazy. We just publish them for free. If someone wants to read this stuff, they just have to go to SitePoint.com and read the 10 articles. And why would anyone ever pay for this? And this started a long history in my time at SitePoint of me saying, this is a crazy idea, it'll never work, and then doing it anyway, and it being a wild success.
Wow, and, interesting.
SitePoint became a book publisher first by publishing that series of articles that I wrote.
Kevin, you're famous. Whoa. I didn't even know.
Because I'm a published author. It doesn't mean as much as it used to, I think.
Well, no, it's because you originated SitePoint's publishing success. Not right. Just like a pub. That's amazing. Way
well,
to go,
if,
Kevin.
If it had been my idea, maybe, but it wasn't. I was trying to talk them out of it every step of the way. But I thought, hey, if you want to pay me a salary to turn this into what was a giant Word document. It was the largest Word doc I'd ever worked on. It was probably 280-ish pages. And
LaTeX was around at the time, wasn't it?
LaTeX?
Yeah, like the markup language for
academics.
Oh,
right, yeah. That was something I knew my university professors used, but I never dabbled in LaTeX.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I used Microsoft Word just because it was around. And yeah, let me tell you, when you put... At least back then, when you put 280 pages with cross-references and figures in Microsoft Word, it strains at the seams. It was crashing regularly. I should never press backspace when my cursor is in a particular position because the document structure explodes when you do that.
Oh, no.
Yeah, just weird stuff like that. But yeah, the first edition of that book was Microsoft Word and printed on demand. We found a place that you could send them a Microsoft Word doc, and they would, anytime we took an order, they would print out a copy. And that was revolutionary at that time.
Wow.
So much so that they had not mastered the art of bookbinding. At that scale, you had to put up with some quality issues. And every once in a while, when someone bought a copy of that book, we would get a photo from them in our support inbox saying, so I got the book I ordered, and it's kind of trapezoidal. Oh, or I got the book you ordered and all the pages fell out when I opened it.
Oh, no.
So it was possible to print books on demand, but it was not the highest quality product. I've still got a couple of copies in my garage of that first edition that I'm afraid to open because the glue has dried and is quite brittle now.
And what kind of numbers were you selling? Thousands? Hundreds? Millions?
Definitely cracked the thousands. But I think that first book would have been declared a success when we had sold hundreds of copies, and we may have sold 1,000 of the first edition. Don't quote me on that. I'd be really interested to go back and remember what, or see what the numbers were. But I get the sense that the scale was around 1,000, at which point we kind of went, okay, well, these quality issues are cropping up. And this is popular enough, and we found enough typos, and PHP has been upgraded to version 4 or whatever. We should do a second edition. And the second edition of that book was the first professionally printed book that SitePoint did. SitePoint quickly got into a partnership with O'Reilly Publishing, which, of course, everyone in programming has heard of O'Reilly.
And your book had an animal on the cover.
They're the animal books. And
that's right.
That was a big deal for me because the books that I learned HTML and CSS from were O'Reilly books. When I was just getting into the web, I asked my parents for programming books for Christmas. That's how big I was into it. I got a book on HTML, a book on CSS, and Dynamic HTML, the definitive guide, I remember was under the Christmas tree one year, this massive thing that it was a complete reference to HTML, CSS, and JavaScript all in one book. You could do that back then. And treasured possession, that book. Just a dictionary of the entire API of the web all in a 1,000 pages. When we partnered up with O'Reilly, it felt like we had made it as a publisher to me, that my words would be scrolling through the same printing presses as O'Reilly books was
as
a big deal to me.
It's amazing. So you then didn't go on to do a master's degree, I'm assuming.
No, just graduated with a Bachelor of Computer Engineering.
And how did you feel? Because I think that the study that I'm doing right now with the master's involves a lot of writing. And I feel like that my technical writing skills were pretty much at their, not the worst, but they were pretty bad when I graduated with my undergraduate. And it's been just experience that's taught me. And then school has helped a lot. So how did you get to the point where you were comfortable enough with your technical writing to take this job? And then how did it improve as you did the job?
I guess I've always been into writing. For as long as writing about technical things was something that I could do. From the very beginning, from my time in the OS2 meetup group, I was always just as excited about sharing what I'd learned as I was about learning it. And at that meetup group, like it was literally 10 to 12 people who got together in a room in the back of a pub in Newcastle once a month. And yet I volunteered to write a newsletter for this thing. And I published it digitally and uploaded it to all the BBSs by hand.
Wow.
And so I guess, I've always been a bit of a know-it-all. I like the idea that I know something that I can share with people and they'll be happy to have learned it. So I guess that's what led me to get a first job, not in building websites for their own sake, but in building websites so that I could learn how to share those skills with other people through my writing.
That's great. Writing is a very important talent because it's not, writing good code is one thing, but being able to translate good code into good prose is an entirely different thing. And I commend you for learning to do that, especially early on.
Those skills, I know what you mean when you say your skills were at their peak when you were writing a really challenging piece of work, because those skills, they come and go just like muscles when you go to the gym. Every once in a while will stumble on an old article I wrote for SitePoint a decade ago, and I'll read it and I'll go, wow, like I can't write that well anymore.
My brain doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't. I'm not that smart anymore.
So how long were you with SitePoint?
I was with SitePoint for 10 going on 11 years. Yeah, what? I was a lifer or nearly so.
Yeah.
I saw SitePoint through many different versions of that business. When I first joined, they were just a tutorial site, entirely ad supported. And they, as we've discussed, transitioned into being a bit of a publisher. And these days, they've moved into a lot of video content and have kind of gone back to their roots of selling writing online, as well as the tech book publishing industry has somewhat faded. I mean, they still do a certain amount of that, but I'd say it's no longer the single overriding focus of their business the way it was for that time in the mid-2000s. And so
that makes sense.
Yeah. So in my time at SitePoint, I was usually on the leading edge of those initiatives. I did the first book, and then I wrote the publishing tool chain that enabled other people to write books for us in DocBook XML format that would then be mm-hmm. rendered both to the web and to PDF for print and to ebook formats eventually. And then I helped them start their video, their online video course formats and contributed to the content management system and that hosted and sold those through SitePoint Premium these days.
Wow.
But, you know, after 10 years in one place, eventually you do start to look at other opportunities. You get a bit of the grass is greener, and you're part of the wallpaper when you've worked in a place for 10 years. And the thing about wallpaper is it often gets taken for granted. And I certainly have no ill will to anyone that I worked with at SitePoint. That was a really special time in my life. And I have lifelong friendships that came out of that job. And I still see one of my SitePoint friends almost every week here in Melbourne. At a certain point, you think, what is the potential of my career and should I be exploring that a bit more? And so I took a job at another startup that was willing to offer me a CTO role. And went back to building the web rather than telling other people how to build the web as my primary job. And that's still what I'm doing today.
So did you miss it once you left the technical writing?
I missed it enough that I still find every excuse I can to do it. I mean, in part, that's why I'm here talking to you today. It's why I speak at conferences and why whenever I give a meetup talk, I'll usually go home and write up a text version of it for my blog as well. And I still find every chance I can to share my skills, although these days that happens more in video form than in writing.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. So tell me about the CTO transition. How did you feel adapting into the role of a CTO? What were some of your new responsibilities and how did you become comfortable with them?
CTO is one of those weird titles that doesn't mean much other than there's no one whose focus is technology who is more senior than you. And depending on the size of your company, that's going to mean different things. So at my scale, when I started in my CTO job, I was working at a company with on the order of 50 people in it, and 2/3 of that were in sales and support. So, a dozen or so technical people or maybe even less than that if you take out things like IT and stuff. But basically, I was doing everything from building our new website infrastructure on Amazon Web Services because there was no one else with server administration experience. So I was doing that myself. But I was also fixing the printer when it broke or tweaking permissions on our Windows file server.
The catch-all technical officer.
I was the catch-all technical. At that scale, it was like if we didn't have anyone employed to do it, then, and it was a technical thing, it floated up the stack until I caught it and had to do something about it. That job, the bulk of that business got sold or acquired, and I went with the rest that didn't get acquired. And so I ended up working for what was a teeny tiny startup with 3 developers, myself included, a marketing person and a CEO. So there was 5 of us in all. And at that scale, being CTO doesn't mean much other than you're the boss of the technical people.
Sure. Was that a new effort or was that just leftover from the previous company?
It was taking the money from the acquisition and applying it to startup ideas and building little MVPs to see what would gain traction.
Oh, so that's interesting. The acquisition I had assumed would have you know, it consumed most of the company and left you to do something else. But what this was you sold off most of the company and stayed what you were and said, okay, let's take this money and do something with it.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't my money. It was my boss's money that we were playing with. And I was grateful for the opportunity to work on Greenfield project after Greenfield project. And it was, I learned a lot in that time because it would be like, okay, well, we're starting with nothing. What should we build it with? And this is, you know, these are good times to learn new skills because you're like, well, I've been writing web applications in PHP all my life, but if we're starting from scratch, well, Ruby on Rails sounds pretty promising. Let's try building it in that and see how it goes. And I was, you know, automating infrastructure in Chef at that time for the first time. And,
right.
Yeah. It's a great, yeah, great environment for picking up new technical skills. And I think that provided a great stepping stone to the next chapter in my career. I think my job here at CultureAmp, I owe a lot to the many new skills I acquired in that chapter.
So tell me then, we're interested in how Elm fits into CultureAmp, and I know we talked about this in a previous episode. It would be good to retouch on it now, but I am also interested in how you became familiar with Elm.
Well, Elm was put to me by a developer that we hired, and we hired him as a back-end developer, but we put him in a team that I was leading. And we were about to have to rewrite the front end of a part of our big application at CultureAmp. And he said, look, I've been playing with this thing called Elm. I think it's amazing. It does a lot of the same stuff that you all seem to like about React, but it's a much better language. It's just much nicer. And I kind of went, oh, okay, sounds interesting. I might look into it at some point. Let's get started on the React code base. But he gave a brown bag or a lunch and learn showing off
right,
Elm.
Yeah.
And that's what really piqued my interest. When I actually saw the code, when I saw what it looked like, when I think the moment that lit me up first was the idea that the view function didn't return just HTML. It returned HTML of your message type. And that therefore that HTML would emit that message type and it couldn't emit anything else. And that provided your update function this guarantee that all it would ever get was the messages emitted by your HTML. And I just, the way that locked together as a Lego brick, it was really satisfying for me. And I thought, ooh, that's something I want to play with. And it piqued enough interest of enough of that team. And we had enough time up our sleeves on that new project that I was like, okay, well, let's build one screen in React and one screen in Elm, and we'll compare and contrast and make a decision after that. Because the developer who was suggesting Elm had never used React in anger, and the rest of us had never used Elm. So we were both talking past each other to a certain extent. So I
sure,
thought
yeah.
If we're going to compare apples to apples, we both have to have had experience on in both stacks. And Elm very quickly won me over. He was halfway through building his React screen when I was like, yeah, you can stop wasting your time. We're switching this to Elm.
That's great. So is that the product now that is in Elm? Or do you have how much Elm code do you think you're using in production right now or in development?
How much Elm? If I had to guess in line numbers, I'd say we're in the tens of thousands of lines of Elm code, maybe.
That's substantial. Yeah.
The CultureAmp application is a single monolithic app still at this point. On the back end, we're splitting services out, but the front end is still monolithic at this point. And it's a survey application. So if your listeners have used something like SurveyMonkey, for example, it's like that, but a very specialized version of it, with survey templates specifically for measuring things like company culture, diversity, team effectiveness, manager effectiveness, those sorts of things. We ask in our surveys questions focused on those. And then we have a big database of survey results from our many clients so that when you complete a survey at your company, you can compare yourself against the benchmarks that we provide for, you know, your industry, for companies your size, for companies in your part of the world, that sort of stuff.
Oh, that's really cool.
So the app is split into experiences like the survey experience. I'm an employee at a company taking a survey. Or the HR manager is the experience. I am building a survey and inviting the employees to take it. Or the manager's experience. I'm logging in after a survey has been completed and I'm viewing the reports. And I'm slicing and dicing the results and comparing my results to other managers in my part of the business. And the part that's built in Elm now at this point, we were launching a new type of survey, the individual effectiveness survey, where this is a survey about your own performance, your own effectiveness, rather than the company as a whole. And rather than everyone in the company taking it, it's a circle of people around you in the company. So a small, what we call N size in statistics, but a small number of participants in the survey feeding in results that you then see in a report. And we started by building the reports in React. And then when we got to the point of writing the screens that provide the workflow around kicking off an individual effectiveness survey process, that's when we switched to Elm. And so all of the workflow around what surveys have I been invited to take, which ones am I coaching people through their results on, and I would like to kick off a new survey with these people invited, all of that user interface is now built in Elm.
Wow. And how has it been? How has it felt in production as a maintenance story?
It's the building new functionality in Elm as we were getting used to it. When we were still learning Elm, it felt about as efficient to build new features in Elm as to build them in React and Redux. Where Elm really sold me was like on day two, when you started second guessing the things you'd built on day one and thought that design decision isn't working out too well. I want to change it. When you do that in our React Redux code base, it fights back and it makes your life difficult. And all the tests you wrote provide friction rather than support in that process. Whereas the Elm code base was like, yeah, change me. I can't wait to change. And I have a compiler that will happily guide you forward through your changes rather than holding you back. That was the moment where I was like, whoa, this is different. This is programming that's helping me do my job rather than a programming language that's providing friction that I have to drag kicking and screaming to the objective I'm going for. And particularly at a company our size that, you know, it has been around for 4 or 5 years now, we have a significant enough code base that developers routinely feel the pain of legacy, of needing to refactor things, of old parts of the code base that don't have sufficient test coverage, so they don't feel confident maintaining or making changes to it. And so the promise of something like Elm, on the front end, no less, but a compiled type language, the difference that we can see in practice of how that's going to change our experience at work day to day, maintaining the stuff that we're writing today in 3 years' time, we are setting ourselves up for such a nicer experience. That's black and white to me. That's night and day difference. It's like, would you sign yourself up for a great experience or a terrible experience? There's not much gray area in between there for me, between Elm and the alternatives.
That's a great endorsement. And I've felt the same way too. I mean, yeah. I haven't deployed to many users what I'm doing yet, and I hope to in the future. But that's the same thing I've experienced as I've developed this. And that's also why I would recommend this to any startup, any people who aren't absolutely 100% sure of what they're doing from the beginning, which is, I think, probably actually everyone. I mean, waterfall seems to be pretty well disproven at this point as a good design approach, because so very seldom, if ever, do we actually know from the beginning what the end is going to look like.
Yeah.
And I think that's where Elm really shines best.
And that's where it shined first for us. And the thing is, I think we found writing new things in Elm to be about on par with React Redux when we were first getting started. And I think that's because at least for myself, I knew React Redux and I knew JavaScript well enough that I wasn't looking up a lot of things. I wasn't sitting and thinking and wondering how to achieve something. I was basically following the patterns that I knew. Whereas at that time in Elm, we were spending a lot of time going, oh, well, there must be a way to do this. What is it?
Yeah, right.
And slowly reading documentation. And the thing about React is it's so popular that if you're like, how do you do this? You can literally just type that into Google and you'll get six Stack Overflow threads providing different advice. And hopefully you don't just copy and paste it from Stack Overflow, but you read through them and make up your own mind. But you, Elm isn't big enough that you have that easy to Google answer for everything you're going to have to implement. Instead, it was a bit slower because you were having to stop and think through and figure it out. And as we've come up to speed on Elm and developed our own patterns in our code base and our own set of examples for how to do all the things we typically have to do in our particular application, that has accelerated. And so now building new stuff in Elm feels more productive than in React Redux because there's so much less boilerplate to write. There are so many, like in our React Redux code base, if you want to add a feature, you have to add it to the view. Then you have to go and find the actions for the Redux and add the actions that you want. And then you have to go to your reducers and add them there. And those are in separate parts of the code base that aren't held together through types. And so it's all a little fragile and error prone. So you write lots of tests to make sure that these things hold together. Whereas in Elm, you just write them and the update function, the types, and the views that all have to do with a piece of data generally are all in the same file. And it's way more productive building new things as well for us now that we've come up to speed.
Yeah, that curve at the beginning can be rough to get through. But I would also argue that I'm a much better programmer for the hours that I've sat at the keyboard not typing any Elm code, but thinking about what I should be typing. They were frustrating at the time, but I really think that the compiler not letting me do things that I wanted to do has shaped my brain into a much better version of my programmer self than I had been previously.
Speaking of my early years at university, the experience of getting into Elm has lit up a bunch of synapses that had been dormant since university because I took this one subject in university that taught me functional programming and I had not used it since. But getting back into or getting into Elm and therefore getting back into functional programming for the first time in 20 years, I've rediscovered all these skills that I owe to this one particular subject I did in my computer engineering degree, and it was called programming languages. And on the first day, the lecturer, whose name I still remember, Prakash Panangadan, I don't remember all my lecturers' names, but this guy was memorable. In our first lecture, he said, "The university requires me to teach you Java. We're going to spend 2 weeks on Java, and then we're going to switch to Scheme, because Java is programming for pinheads, and Scheme is real programming."
Wow.
And what I didn't know at the time was that's the functional programming object-oriented argument. And he was firmly on the side of functional programming, despite the university's curriculum being stacked against him. And so we had a whirlwind tour of Java in 2 weeks, and then we started solving functional programming problems. And I put it that way because that's how functional programming felt to me at the time. Writing functional programs, at least in a language like Scheme, felt like solving Sudoku problems, where I'd be like, well, I know what half of this program is going to look like, but the other half is a mystery. And you throw numbers at the wall until something sticks and you're like, oh, that's the recursive algorithm that'll get this done. And you feel so smart when you work it out. Elm is much friendlier than Scheme. Scheme is one of these Lisp-like languages where it's parentheses all the way down.
And it's interpreted, right? So it doesn't help you much.
Yeah, it either works or it doesn't, and there's not much guiding you as you write your code. But I learned about currying in that class, and any built-in skills I had for functional programming before I started writing Elm, I owe to that one class in university.
Well, that's fantastic. I think we've reached our time.
All right.
Which is great. I mean, way to end it right on the 1 hour mark.
Boom.
Fantastic, Kevin. So thank you. That's a fascinating story, and I'm glad that we got to participate in your life a little bit, go into your pensieve of the past and get it some experience. Do you have a pick, Kevin?
I do have a pick. I've been giving a lot of meetup talks lately about Elm, and I even had the privilege of speaking at RailsConf in Phoenix, Arizona. And if you're interested in checking that out, you can just search for developer happiness on the front end with Elm. And there's a couple of versions of that talk now. I've recorded a nice polished one with my good microphone if you want to see the high-quality version of that talk. But because of this, I've been giving a lot of thought to how do you present Elm to an audience for the first time in a way that will persuade them to spend some of their own time looking into it and to hopefully pick it up and try writing some. And I've come up with some of my own ways. I've been inspired by like our friend Richard Feldman, who's done tons of talks of this nature and is really good at it, if you ask me. But the latest example of this I've seen was by Teresa Sokol, who's also from No Red Ink. And she gave a talk called Putting the Fun in Functional with Elm at React Europe 2017. And that has just gone up on YouTube in the past week. It's a nice short 15-minute talk. And there is basically no code in the talk. And the angle she takes is that if you've worked in something like React Redux, those code bases are held together by the discipline of the developers maintaining them. And if you have a bad day or you need to ship a feature quickly, it is very common for your discipline to slip and for you to make a little mess by tying two things together that shouldn't be tied together in your code base, by putting some state in a place where you don't want state in your system, and promising yourself that you're going to come back and clean that up. But inevitably, you don't have time to clean up all of your messes, and gradually your code base atrophies until you have to do a big painful refactor to get out from under that technical debt. Whereas she contrasts this with her experience with Elm, where the language is very strict, the environment is very strict, and you have very limited tools for making messes. And as a result, when you want to take a shortcut or ship something quickly by making a mess, usually the compiler says, sorry, you're not allowed to do that, and you have to build it the right way the first time. And what that results in is a code base that remains really maintainable and really well assembled over a long period of time. And I think that is a new angle for selling Elm, particularly to companies that are already well invested in React Redux. They might have a big code base and they might be thinking, well, okay, Elm is this new kid on the block. It's probably good, but we're already up to speed on React Redux. So is it so much better that we would actually change? I think this is a great angle for saying, well, here's some pain that you probably feel on a daily basis that would completely go away if you switch to Elm. And it's a well-delivered, entertaining talk besides all that. So Putting the Fun in Functional with Elm by Teresa Sokol on YouTube. Check it out.
Excellent, and great endorsement too. Thanks, Kevin. And that's your one pick, right?
That's it.
Well, I'm not doing any picks this week. I'm taking a pick break. So that's it. That's the show. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for having me on, Murphy. It was great to go down memory lane with you.
Absolutely. And we'll have you back again in the future to talk about more cool stuff you've been doing, Kevin.
Appreciate it. I can't wait.
All right. Bye, everybody. Bye.